You're listening to St. Pete X Season 2. This episode is brought to you by the St. Petersburg Foundation. The St. Petersburg Foundation builds capacity at the organizational and community levels to increase social impact. For more information, visit stpete.foundation. That's stpete.foundation. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX today is the venerable master journalist, but more importantly, 24 hours retired journalist, Margie Manning. Welcome.
Thanks, Joe. It's funny to look at you from this side of the table.
I know. I was like, the gloves are off now. What's going on? Well, we're here to celebrate you because you've had an amazing career. You've been at the core of business journalism in the area for many, many years and doing great work even before that as well. So I want to get your take on the state of journalism. I want to get your take on the state of journalism in St. Pete. But before that, I want to make sure people get a chance to know a little bit about you and some of your history and what brought you to this plateau of mastery that we've got to experience here at The Catalyst for the last couple of years. So let's go back to your roots in writing.
So I went to University of Missouri Columbia Journalism School, which at the time, and still is, a very preeminent journalism school. But I landed there by accident. I really wanted to be a Broadway star when I started college. And I quickly realized I couldn't sing and I wasn't going to be in the spotlight. So I shifted gears. And I was intrigued by, actually, do you remember the Patty Hearst kidnapping?
Yes.
That story just captivated my attention. Not so much from the story perspective, but from the idea of the people who were on the radio who were telling the story. I majored in radio journalism. And that's how I started my career at a small radio station in northern Missouri, KIRX.
Right. So you're talking about, I hear you say Broadway, and I hear you say the radio folks telling the story. That lens is probably more on the performative side and less on the journalism side. So is that the part that you enjoyed in the beginning? And then was there a slow, gradual shift into appreciating the actual digging and journalism side?
That's exactly right. I was very, I guess, self-centered. I wanted to be the star in the spotlight. But I quickly fell in love with telling the stories. And I realized the story had a lot more ability to connect with people. And covered stories like a standoff of a young man who held a hostage in a cemetery. And covered stories about a notable banker who was accused in a Ponzi scheme in this small town in northern Missouri. And discovered that I really enjoyed letting people hear the story unfold, following the events, putting in the background so people had context for it, and bringing some resolution to it as well. It was very satisfying to be able to learn how to tell people about the events that are going on in their community and what relevance it had to them.
Right. It kind of makes me think of one of the interesting points of journalism is that with a traditional story, it's usually the climax at the end. But with journalism, you kind of have to say, here's the big news. Here's the biggest part of this story is the first line of the story or second line of the story. And from there is supporting stuff. So it's a little bit reverse of a standard storytelling method.
It is. And I think when it's done well, you are telling the end of the story. But as you build a news story, you're providing context throughout, and you're providing different perspectives from people who've participated in the story. A good writer will use their own expertise to provide a nut graph or kind of sum up for the reader. This is why it should matter to you. And so it's a really unique construct when you're writing a news story.
Yeah. And when you talk about, you know, the skill of the writer, the expertise of the writer, obviously the big underlying sentiment in journalism is objectivity, but you know, you also need to understand that the readers need to receive the information in a way that's pleasant or else they won't receive it. And so how do you find your creative space in writing objective news stories?
Well, I always try to distance myself from the story. Obviously, I have opinions, lots of opinions about the things that I hear in terms of, you know, perhaps a business has made an announcement about something they're going to do or the city council's taken some action. I think I've learned through the years, and good journalists do this, that my opinions don't really matter. And if I try and dig into the perspective of what's being said from each person who's talking, it's a much more compelling story. It's a much more well-rounded story. And that's my aim, to let people know well, this person may have this view of what's going on. This person has this view of what's going on. You know, here are different perspectives. A lot to think about.
Yeah, and I think that's really key is blending those perspectives because, you know, how seen from the front, the back, the inside, or above is the same house. You know, and all the perspectives are technically true. They're just different views of the house.
Exactly.
You know, the cynics will say that objectivity is impossible. Others will say that that's just part of the job, that being a professional means just being able to do that. You know, how difficult did you find it to really maintain objectivity when you wrote?
Well, I will agree. Objectivity, complete objectivity is impossible. You're going to pick and choose quotes and facts that each writer will pick those that seem pertinent to what they're writing about. You may leave something out that somebody else would say is extremely pertinent, but the writer doesn't see it that way. But I think just trying to step outside yourself, remembering that you are, the writer is serving the reader, not their own interest, is very helpful in trying to maintain as much objectivity as possible.
And do you think, you know, I sometimes see objectivity happens at the expense of expertise in that you sort of have to overlay this blanket of objectivity because you don't know who is trying to manipulate, you know, the narrative. And the reality is that, you know, everybody is manipulating the narrative in the sense that they have their own perspective, but most people aren't doing it with that sort of "we're trying to fool you" intention behind it. So it seems like, you know, there's a very few people that are really out there to, you know, scam in the way they share information. The rest of the people just share what they know. But it seems like, you know, we sort of have to discount or treat almost everybody as if they may be on the more manipulative end of things, because how do we ever tell the difference?
Well, you know, I think that's where research is really important to combine with writing skills. If I hear somebody say something and it seems questionable, or I read a statistic that seems questionable, I won't write about it until I've researched it. Luckily, in this day and age, we have tons of tools at our fingertips that we can research almost anything. You mentioned expertise, and I think, you know, you build that over years and years and years, and sometimes getting burned by writing something that was not correct. I think those two skills have to blend together.
I agree. Let's pick back up. So we left on our tangent, you were at the radio station, and let's keep going from there.
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and had an opportunity to go back to St. Louis to work for what was then probably one of the most powerful radio stations of its era, KMOX Radio in St. Louis. That was such an experience. I worked with lots of talented people, big names that people would know, like Jack Buck, and Bob Costas, and Art Fleming, the former Jeopardy host, but other names people would never know, but people who are extremely talented reporters and writers. It was really the heyday of radio, especially in St. Louis. We invented NPR pretty much before NPR invented itself, because we had all kinds of documentary series on that looked at important topics, things that radio won't touch for the most part anymore, like public health and child welfare and conditions in jails. At the time, there was a policy in place called the Fairness Doctrine. And radio broadcast outlets were required to present a balanced view of controversial issues. When the Fairness Doctrine went away in the late 80s, so did a lot of the great radio programming. And radio changed. When the Fairness Doctrine went away, Rush Limbaugh started to rise to ascendancy. And that was about the time I knew I needed to get out of radio. So I went to the St. Louis Business Journal. It was a big shift to go from radio to a print publication, and it was strictly a print publication at the time. But I'd been developing an interest in business news because I was doing a kind of a weekly program on personal economics on KMOX. Of course, there's personal economics and business news are really two separate animals, but I wasn't sophisticated enough to know that at the time. I learned it and really found a niche in business news. I loved it because business is so important to so much of what we do every day. You know, the jobs we go to, the way our employers will make decisions that affect our lives, the buildings they build in real estate news, the civic commitments that businesses are willing to make. It touches so many things, and I really became fascinated with it.
When you were doing the radio work, were you pre-writing what you were going to say, or was it, so there was some writing happening there?
Yes, but writing for broadcast is so different than writing for print.
So what was the learning curve then to get into, say, hey, here's how you do a business journal article?
It was fairly steep. I had to learn not to talk in present tense, but past tense, how to put words in quotes. I had to learn how to take real notes instead of relying on a tape recorder when I was doing interviews, but it was a great learning experience because it helped me organize my thoughts a little better. And again, it was another step outside of myself to put myself in the view of somebody who's picking up a newspaper and reading it.
Right. You know, business people can be strange animals, right? They are, especially entrepreneurs, are kind of a breed unto themselves. Did it immediately feel like, I guess I would say, a different language, but also, you know, it's a completely different value system in a way than with, you know, life and death in medicine or human rights or environmental issues. And they do feed into that as well. But what did it seem like coming in sort of fresh to this business community?
Well, it was a learning curve, like I said. Initially, I was assigned to cover banking. Banking has its own very distinct jargon. I was lucky enough to have a banker who, I guess, took pity on me and sat me down and said, here are the terms that you need to know, what they mean, and why they're important. And when you hear it from the perspective of somebody who's deep in the industry, you know, why it matters that a bank gets a return on assets. It matters because the people who've invested in the bank want to, you know that their investment's paying off. So I think it was helpful to hear from the business people themselves why they do what they do, why they're passionate about it. And that really helped with that transition from covering civic issues, which have this kind of obvious public impact, to the more niche business sector, because that also has an impact. But you need to see it through business people's eyes, I think.
And being on the front lines like that and being the lens through which the community really sees this business, was there an energy from these folks knowing that you were going to be that lens and, you know, being new to the business, did you feel a pressure?
I wouldn't say pressure. I guess I had good editors, a good publisher who kind of coached me along. And that's also key, you know, and at time, especially the business journals, and I would wager other publications too, had large enough staffs that there was a lot of mentoring going on, coaching, hands-on editing. Today, I think a lot of that is gone. Staffs are much thinner. Reporters are expected to do more of their own kind of self-editing. But that wasn't true at the time. That wasn't the case at the time. And I think all those things really helped ease the transition.
And there can be a shift in energy because half the time you want something from them, you want that information, and they may be reluctant to give it, depending on the nature of the story. And the other half of the time, they may become what you say and take this information, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's always sort of a back and forth on which way, you know, the information wants to flow.
And too, though, a good reporter, you know, there is still that performance element to it. You know, a good reporter is not going to just go up to somebody and say, I'm a reporter, give me the story. You learn, you know, how to socialize with people. At least I learned how to socialize with people. I guess I'm an introvert and I had to learn that. Maybe it comes more naturally for other people. But you learn, you know, you become not friends with your sources, but you learn what's driving them and how to communicate with them, how to speak their language, how to know what they're interested in sharing and how to coax out of them even a little bit more than they're interested in sharing. So it's kind of a give and take. To some extent, it works best. I have found that if the reporter is also willing to share a little bit about themselves too, you know, I've talked to people about my, you know, family when it had absolutely nothing to do with the story, or, you know, shared some holiday event or something like that. But it can't be just a one-way relationship. It has to be, I think, two ways. I wish I really, really wish I would have learned that a little sooner. I think I would have been a little more successful.
Well, I mean, you know, all the evidence I have is that everything you just talked about needs to stand up over time as well, because you have to, if you're going to be a long-term member of a community, which, you know, as you grow trust over time, it gives you more access and lets you do your job more effectively. And, you know, certainly you had to have felt the outpouring of appreciation and love as you retired. here, and you know, everybody from, you know, business leaders to political leaders, and they, you know, they all stepped up to show their appreciation. And I think
that was nice.
Yeah, that's evidence that you did that just right.
Thank you, Joe.
So we're now in St. Louis, and at what point do we get a irresistible hankering for ice cream? Are we close to that yet?
Yes. So 9/11 happened, which caused, I think, everybody to kind of rethink what they were doing in life, including my husband, who was working for MasterCard, which had a large operations center in St. Louis, who always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And we'd been coming down to the St. Petersburg area for vacations for many years because his family had relocated here. And we were out on Madeira Beach visiting one of our favorite spots, Candy Kitchen, when we saw a little sign in the window that said, franchisees wanted. And my husband's entrepreneurial bug kicked in big. We pursued this opportunity and eventually became a franchisee of Candy Kitchen with our own store out on Treasure Island. And I decided I would help him with that. I'd been writing about business for many years. Now it was time to be a business person myself. So I quit journalism for several months. Went into this retail business with him, doing everything from building out the interior of the store to setting up the accounting system to learning how to make ice cream. And eventually, when I came down here, I did talk to the Tampa Bay Business Journal, which is a sister publication to the one I worked with in St. Louis. I talked to the Tampa Bay Times. I talked to the then Tampa Tribune. Nobody was really interested in me. So I just worked for a while at the store. Then I got a call about 6 months later from the Tampa Bay Business Journal asking if I was still interested. And I was, as often happens with people who switch jobs, our healthcare benefits under COBRA were running out. So it was useful to be able to have healthcare again. And went to work for the Tampa Bay Business Journal in March 2003. I felt like the skills I had started to build at St. Louis Business Journal just kicked into hyperdrive down here. I don't know if it's because I took some time off and had that real life business experience, albeit, you know, a small business, but real life experience. I'm not sure why, but I really feel like once I got to Tampa, I was able to just expand into so many more areas of business coverage, ask deeper and more insightful questions. You know, I think a part of it too, though, had to do with technology, because in the early 2000s, of course, with the dot-com growth, so many more resources became available to everybody, also journalists. And that was very helpful too.
And I think a lot of times when you cut loose of something, because if you start somewhere, right, and you come in fresh, even though people turn over and even though you grow in your career, there's still sort of a, you know, the roots of when you were just new and coming up in the world are always kind of there and reflected in the people who were on that journey with you. And when you cut loose and come here, the whole slate is wiped clean and you can be more reflective of who you actually are at that point too, and not have some of those sort of like, oh, I remember when, right? And, you know, I still get that here because I know people that saw when we first started our businesses and, you know, they were very small and we were doing, you know, little cute things. And, you know, to a lot of people in the community that, you know, those roots will always be there, right? And so I think, you know, I think cutting loose gives and that fresh start lets you bloom into where you should be.
Yeah, because when I started the St. Louis Business Journal, I was a novice print reporter. When I came here, I was an experienced one.
That's right. And people treated you that way. And you filled the way people treated you, which is a good lesson for everybody to make sure that they get treated where they are now, not where they were in the past.
That's exactly right. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you.
All right. So let's walk through the, 15 years?
Yes. And boy, I covered some amazing stories at Tampa Bay Business Journal. The biggest shift during that time, though, was, of course, from being an all-print publication to becoming a combination print and digital publication with the pretty much 24/7 news demands. It was gradual over time, but it went from being, you know, a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job to, you know, there were weekends involved and nights, and that's okay. I love that. But it does put a different perspective on the way you write things. So what was interesting while I was at the Tampa Bay Business Journal, I think the biggest shift was from being a strictly print publication to being a combination print and digital. And the nature of the business sort of changed with that. And in many ways a good way. We had closer connections with our readers through various events and a lot of opportunities to be together in person. It also, though, shifted the nature of what we were writing. And I think we lost a little bit of depth in there. I think there was a little more interest in getting short, quick stories online and not so much the depth that had originally drawn me to print and business journalism.
Yeah, and social media, just in general, played a big role in that, because now the average person, if you know someone and they come something with, you won't believe what happened to our cat, right? I mean, yeah. And just because you know them and they're able to get to you and write that in a post, then they get benefit from the attention that comes from that too. It just really funneled people and incentivized people to do that sort of thing. And people didn't expect much more than that. And so that, I think, for a long time, that, people had to follow what they thought was getting the attention. But over time, I don't know if that stood up really, if, you know, eventually people got burned out by just the headlines and now are back to seeking more depth.
Well, I hope that's the case. I mean, I think that's what we have been doing here at Catalyst.
Yeah.
I think that there is a hunger for people to get multiple perspectives that it can only be presented in an in-depth story. And I hope that more people are realizing that they need to see multiple perspectives in order to make up their mind about an issue.
And I think where we ended up with that is some number of people came back to wanting that, but also there are the tools out there for non-news organizations to give that depth as well, and specifics, you know, because, you know, if I care very much about an environmental issue, I may want to listen to a person who has studied that their whole life more than a journalist. And now I can, right? I could watch them talk for 2 hours on YouTube or whatever. So that's emerged maybe a more compact, but still more important role for the journalist to sort of be the glue that stitches together all of the happenings in a way that, you know, sees what the sum of all the parts end up being.
That's exactly right. I think that, yeah, you can watch somebody you really respect and believe in on YouTube, but you may not get another perspective on that. And that's where good long-form journalism does come in.
You know, but the other side of that is that it makes it harder for bigger organizations to really thrive in the way they used to, because that need can be served to some extent with a compact staff. I mean, we've managed to do it pretty well in St. Pete with, you know, 2 and 3 full-time employees. Or the one big thing we lose is the even longer form of investigative journalism. Again, I don't know that the financials dictate that. Someone can just carve out for 6 months and really get deep into something and win a Pulitzer for it. You know, that's the one thing I don't think that anybody's figured out yet as to how to keep news orgs of that size viable at the local level.
That's true. And, you know, when I say long-form journalism, I'm talking about maybe a 1,200-word news story.
Right, yeah.
Which is, at a lot of publications, that would be, you know, the cover story for a week, you know. Whereas here, we routinely do those.
Yeah.
I should clarify, that's what I'm talking about with long-form journalism.
And going back to that collection point, I think also that, you know, as we talked about, like the rule that was in place way back
when. The fairness doctrine.
Fairness, yeah, doctrine. Back then, it was probably a lot of it was just A or B, right? And now today is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, because all the different perspectives have evolved so much and have those channels like the YouTubes to let themselves grow into something viable. So again, that comes back to the role of the journalist stitching together those 12 perspectives into one piece, and that's hard to do in 400 words.
That's exactly right. You hit on it totally.
So coming from, I mean, you know, I guess I'd love to hear, coming from such a long history of, you know, journalism, whatever you call the, you know, the business journalism, this traditional journalism, you know, kind of into this weird experiment that we had, or we have at the Catalyst, you know, and I would say largely you dictated a lot of what it is too, but how did you experience that when you first showed up?
Well, the reason I decided to make the move was because, Joe, you said to me, if you find an interesting business news story, you go cover it. It is so freeing for a journalist to be let out of a box, because so many places, you know, news outlets, you're told you cover this kind of story. And just the trust that you had in me, that if I found it interesting, readers would find it interesting, that was an amazing thing. And I think it's true. You know, I think that I'm kind of not an extraordinary person, kind of a usual person. If I find it interesting, I think a lot of readers do find it interesting, in all honesty. I guess we kind of made it up as we went along. I mean, I knew how to write a news story, and you knew how to position it so it looked great on a digital platform. and to invite comments to it. And I think we just kind of melded our skills, you know, to make it work.
One thing I remember resonating with you, I felt, was that being drawn to make the community better. And, you know, because I didn't come at this from a traditional journalism background, obviously. I came at it from a community building intention. And, you know, I figured we can tell the stories, even if they're tough conversations. We can have the tough conversations, but we can do it in a way that is additive, where we're saying, hey, let's have this sort of underlying, almost replacing it. We're still objective, but our underlying theme is we're all in this together. We're all working to make things better. We're going to disagree. But if we can tell the stories in a way that have an energy of alignment versus an energy of shaming or exposure or whatever. And, you know, and I wasn't sure how that would map over to traditional journalism, which a lot of times is exposés and things like that. And that's why I was so happy with how we melded, is that you just naturally took to being able to tell the story, but doing it in a way that built people up. Even again, if it was a tough conversation, but, you know, if you're having a conversation with someone and they know you have their best interest in mind, and here we're thinking the community as a whole, people are going to buy into it. And that in turn starts a positive loop of them helping us do better work because they have that trust and they do feel like they're in it with us.
I'll give you a perfect example. The very last story I wrote for Catalyst, it started with a tough conversation. There are 5 neighborhoods in South St. Petersburg where fewer than half the households have access to high-speed broadband connectivity. That means it's tough for those people who don't have it. During the pandemic, it was tough for them to go to school because our school was online, tough to apply for a job, tough to get health care. You had to see your doctor online. That's a hard conversation to have, and it's hard to have it without blaming those people who, for whatever reason, can't afford. And that's the reason they can't afford to have that high-speed connectivity. But there are groups out there that are working to address this. You helped me find one of them, Digital Inclusion Working Group, which is a combination of the Innovation District, Deuces Live, and a whole bunch of other organizations working together on this. And that told readers that there are ways to address these community problems, our community issues, in a positive manner that benefits everybody. And I think that's the kind of journalism that Catalyst is doing best.
I like it. I agree with that. So where do you see, as you sort of look forward to where journalism is going, and I'm here hoping for some advice here for us, for me, what else do we need to do better as an industry, as the Catalyst? You know, what do you see, because you have such a long history in the business, that worries you and what gives you optimism?
I think something that journalism needs to do and is doing very well, including at Catalyst, is to continue to broaden perspectives. And specifically, so many people who have risen to higher levels in journalism still are white people, a lot of white males, though not all. I think journalism needs to be much more open to people of color, who bring their own perspectives, their own view of, you know, the quotes that are important, to go back to what I said earlier, the quotes that are important, the facts to include. I think that would really benefit communities to be hearing stories told from the perspective of people of color. And it's happening. I think it needs to continue to happen more. I'm glad we have Waveney, who writes for us every week. But what gives me hope is the enthusiasm I see of young journalists who are coming into the profession with great technical tools, tools that I had to spend years learning. They just know, they've grown up with them, and without a lot of the biases that so many older journalists have brought into the conversation.
So if we sort of look at social media in the media sense, right? And you know, you can go on YouTube, to mention YouTube again, and see movies or shows or whatever you call them that people have made in their, you know, bedroom that are as slick as Star Wars was 10 years ago, right? So, you know, by essentially giving tools, best practices, and a platform and some incentives, the individual has been able to really do things that have unleashed creativity at a really granular, wonderful level. Now you see the Substacks over the world. Obviously, at Catalyst, I've mentioned that we're aspiring to build these tools out so folks can contribute. Do you see a world where individuals, given the support and the tools and the best practices, can be social journalists and have sort of a tapestry of many of those working independently together?
Yes, and I still think there is value in formal journalism training, in learning, you know, how to ask questions, how to see from other people's perspectives what's going on. I think there's more responsibility on a reader or an audience of a video platform to realize that what they're seeing, perhaps from an individual, is not the whole story that they might be getting from a legitimate news source. I guess my bias still tends to be on organized news sources.
Sure.
But there is great information out there. But I think it comes with realizing on the part of the consumer of that information, they have a responsibility as well.
That makes sense. So what's next?
I'm kind of, in a way, going back into business, but for a nonprofit, actually for my church. I'll be president of the Board of Trustees at my church for the next year, which will be another interesting experience in helping run a nonprofit organization, faith-based organization. So that'll be keeping me busy for a while.
Sounds wonderful. Well, I've said it's, you know, many ways, but I want to put it on the record here on SPX that we could not have gotten the Catalyst to where we have without you. And you've taught me pretty much everything I know. Bill taught me a few things and you untaught me some of that stuff, which was great. Just kidding, Bill. But yeah, you've taught us how to be a news organization, and you've taught all the young journalists that we brought in how to be a news organization. And you've evolved wonderfully to help us be a news organization that can be positive, which I really, until a couple of years in, didn't appreciate how rare and wonderful that was, that you were able to make that transition and support that mission while still being totally legitimate in our practices. So I think that was a real lucky break, and I will always appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Joe. And what's next for Catalyst?
What's next for Catalyst is a grand vision of building a platform and providing all kinds of amazing tools to our schools and our neighborhood associations and our artists, so that they can put their content up onto the platform and we can get people back to wearing their local hat, get them away from some of the the more divisive national ideologies that are really driving the bigger platforms, and let us celebrate news feeds with our local schools, our local neighborhood associations, our local nonprofits, our local artists, and have that take a little bit of our mindset time to balance out some of the bigger stuff. So that's what's next for us.
Well, that's exciting. I'll keep reading.